This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and five specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Thank you for supporting WBEZ. You keep public media public. December gifts are among the most important because they set the tone for our reporting in 2026. Next year, we're doubling down on bringing you stories that arm you with the facts. This journalism relies on everyone contributing what they can. Join them today at wbez.org/donate.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We made it to the end of the week. For us, that means it's time to dig deeper into the biggest stories of the last few days in our weekly news recap. Stories like these.
The Chicago City Council got the ball rolling on banning natural gas appliances in new construction in the city.
But there are a couple of things they did not do. One was take up the matter of lease arbitration, and the union says that's not fair.
A chaotic day at City Hall. Aldermen were met with a series of interruptions after a scheduled vote on a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza was yet again delayed. Expect a showdown on charter schools. The school board begins reviewing them and will decide on new contracts, if any. And it could affect tens of thousands of students in our area.
Our panel of journalists is Lee John Greco, government and politics reporter for Crane Chicago Business, Madison Saavedra, Block Club Chicago reporter, and Brandon Pope, reporter and anchor at CW26 and host of WBEZ's Making podcast. We kicked off the recap with Lee filling us in on a contentious issue, the future of charter schools.
Yeah, so Chicago Board of Ed renewed contracts for 49 charter schools. So that's renewing agreements with 12 networks. And basically, the max extension that the board could have given these charter schools was 10 years, but they renewed most of them for 3 or 4 years. They also set some conditions like monitoring services for students with disabilities and students who are learning English as a new second language.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously this is a little contentious given, you know, where the board stands today. Mm-hmm. It's a board appointed by the mayor who's a, you know, former CTU member. And, you know, on top of that, the board recently passed a resolution stating their intention to move away from school choice and focus on sending resources to neighborhood schools. Now, to be fair, that resolution doesn't call for closing any of the charter schools.
Right.
But the board is saying that they are going to take a closer look at that.
Yeah, you mentioned the mayor there, Lee. Where does he stand? We know he's a former public school teacher, organizer for the teachers union. Where does he stand on this issue?
Well, on the charter schools issue, I guess what I can say, the mayor's been, you know, pretty careful about weighing in on this. I remember I asked him about the board earlier this fall because the State House is trying to figure out basically the structure of the school board, whether it's going to be entirely elected or appointed. And so I think the mayor has been really careful not to weigh in on these issues,
yeah,
given his background.
The charter schools, they wanted their contracts renewed for 10 years, but they've been coming under intense scrutiny around things like special ed services, right? I mean, do you think they're feeling less confident now about their future?
I think I can't speak for how they're feeling, but I think that would be fair to say, given,
yeah,
you know, what the max extension is and what they're getting and, you know, the fact that the board is probably going to change, you know, in that next election, however,
yeah,
it's structured. And so, yeah, things are a little tenuous for them.
Yeah, for sure. Brandon, are you at all surprised hearing, you know, Johnson make life a little tougher for charter schools?
Well, it's not surprising given the background, but he's tried to walk a line here. He's, you know, his background would say, I mean, they've been pretty anti-charter schools with CTU, yet he's now tried to say, yeah, but I'm not against them existing overall. He's got to walk that line because it's a very contentious issue. We already know the political pressure happening around numerous issues in Chicago. And once this dropped, this proposed resolution to, really promote neighborhood schooling, it got a lot of people riled up there. So he's trying to ease tensions at this point. He's walking a delicate line.
Madison, what about families that live in neighborhoods that you cover? How do you think they're feeling? Like in Pilsen, how would they be affected?
Well, I imagine there's a lot of feelings among those families that they want more attention and focus on their and, you know, resources directed towards their neighborhood schools. That's something I have reported on and spoken to families about, not particularly recently. But those big neighborhood schools where, you know, it pulls a lot of kids in and they don't have things like, you know, great, you know, programs like after school programs get cut, their athletic programs like don't get particularly funded. You know, those are the issues that have lasted for, you know, quite a while.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's maybe I should probably do some more reporting on it.
It's actually interesting you mentioned that, Madison, and looking at Little Village specifically, I remember going there on the day of the mayoral election last year, and folks weren't talking about voting for Brandon Johnson. They were talking about voting against Paul Vallis for those very reasons that you mentioned, because they felt like, he was taking away resources from those neighborhood schools. So I think that is really an issue that hits that community hard. And, you know, that's why people are getting so riled up about this.
Well, let's turn to city council now. Mayor Johnson entered the heated debate over what is happening in Gaza. So let's hear a little bit of what he said in council chambers on Wednesday.
At this point now, I believe we're looking at 25,000 Palestinians that have been killed during this war. And the killing has to stop. So, yes, we need a ceasefire.
What do you think, Brandon? I mean, does Johnson risk alienating parts of Chicago's Jewish community with that position?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the most contentious issues of our time. But it's not only the Jewish community he risks alienating. He has to walk a tight line because he's the most prominent mayor in American cities right now to actually endorse a ceasefire in Gaza. You also have the DNC coming here in 2024, the Democratic Party having an internal battle over where they stand on this Israel-Palestine conflict. And here's Brandon Johnson in ground zero of where the Democrats are going to be gathering, taking a hardline stance here. That's going to apply some pressure to Joe Biden and his administration, which are getting a lot of heat because of their stance on Gaza and what's happening over there.
Yeah. The city council was originally scheduled to vote on a ceasefire resolution on Wednesday, right, Lee?
Yes.
What happened?
So a couple things happened this week, actually, earlier in the week. So there's this resolution to call for a ceasefire, and 28 alders led by the only Jewish alderwoman, or alderperson, rather, in city council, Deb Silverstein, called to delay that until after Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is January 27th. And so, of course, the progressives who led that resolution, really kind of took umbrage with that.
Mm-hmm.
From their point of view, it is actually, in a way, fitting to call for a ceasefire because of how many Palestinians have died there. And so essentially what happened was, like a couple of things at city council this week, it was punted. So they're probably going to revisit it on January 31st.
So it's pushed now to next week. City council is also considering new regulations for dollar stores. Madison, what's going on?
So, yeah, similarly, the city council was supposed to vote on an ordinance that would prohibit dollar stores from opening within a mile of an existing location owned by the same company. So that's things like Dollar Store, but also Dollar Tree, which are I believe, owned by the same company. It's being spearheaded by Alderman Matt O'Shea, the 19th Ward. It was originally, introduced back in October. And I believe it stems from just a number of issues that older people have spoken about with dollar stores. Things like it just being really dirty, like the inside of the store and the outside of the store. I believe Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor spoke about this during the license meeting earlier this week.
Wonderful that you should bring her up. Let's listen to the 20th Ward Alder telling City Council what she thinks of the dollar stores in her Southside neighborhood.
Their stores are filthy. They don't keep the trash up in front of the communities. In my community, there's one a block up from my house, and every other week I'm calling them about a gate that's down, which causes people to come in and out of that portion of the community. I would love for y'all to put up a map to show where they're concentrated at, and I guarantee you I know exactly where they're concentrated at.
Concerns then, Madison, that restricting dollar stores could limit options for lower income families and for those on a budget?
Yes, that is a concern, and that's what some of the critics are saying. Also in a statement, the Dollar Tree spokesperson urged older people to rescind the proposal and instead collaborate with the company. But what I thought was funny, maybe a little interesting, Alderman Ronnie Mosley mentioned that he's had consistent issues with stores in his far south side ward, but he had never heard from company representatives until this ordinance introduced in the fall.
And that's sort of the whole reason why they did this. Mm-hmm. They're hoping that by passing something like this, it applies that pressure to these companies to keep their stores more put together. Because, I mean, let's be honest, if you go out and see some of them, Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor, she ain't lying. Mm-hmm. Like, there's
she has a point.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's really bad. Trash everywhere. Just it's bad.
When do we expect the ordinance to get voted on?
So it's been delayed until the next city council meeting, which is scheduled for next week, January
31st. I see. And you have thoughts?
I was just going to say, to that point on applying pressure, sometimes even if an ordinance fails, just by getting it out there and kind of airing dirty laundry, that does apply pressure on these companies.
Mm-hmm. Sure does.
I think that's the hope.
Absolutely. And we've all been turning up the heat in our homes over the last few weeks. I know I have.
I've been trying not to. I've been trying to hold on.
Well, one night my daughter turned it up way too much. It was literally like a scene out of a movie. Got up and, you know, middle of the night, dripping sweat. And I was like, who is responsible for this? How we heat our homes, that may change if our mayor has his way. So tell us what the mayor is proposing, Lee.
Yeah, so this would effectively ban natural gas in any new construction, but also additions. Like a few of the things this week, this was punted. Another delay. It was sent to rules. Basically, what happens in city council is, I guess if I were to sketch out an I'm just a bill sort of thing here, when something is sent to rules, that's a way to delay it because then council has to vote to get it out of rules and then send it to the relevant committee. And so that's what happened with this ban, this proposed ban this week.
Which was supposed to apply to both new home and business construction.
Yeah, right? Commercial and home. And then, as I mentioned, that addition part, I spoke with Alderwoman Maria Haddon about this earlier this week. That's still a negotiation in terms of, you know, what percentage would constitute a major renovation. So it seems that it, you know, would apply to major heating renovations and that sort of thing, but also, like, you know, how much of your house or commercial business or whatever is going under renovation.
It's really important to note the proposal wouldn't require existing homes and businesses to switch to electric appliances and get rid of gas furnaces, right? What is the argument that the mayor's making in support of this?
Yeah, so this fits in with one of his campaign promises, to environmentalists, basically, that switching over to not only electric, but also other types of renewables that might be available in the future, will help people. The opposition is coming out from kind of two different camps. You have, you know, your trade unions. When I was at city council on Monday, there were a whole bunch of trade guys showing up, the pipe fitters union, they're against this. Of course, on the business side, you have People's Gas. But then you also had the Southland Black Chamber of Commerce, who is arguing that, you know, this is going to hurt Black communities. It's going to hurt people who rely on gas. And, you know, it might be too expensive for them to switch over to electric. Or if the power goes out in these really cold months like we've had, and you only have electric heat, then you're kind of, you know, up a creek without a paddle.
Yeah. I mean, and Brandon and Madison, I mean, what do you think? Even if this gas ban doesn't pass, I mean, do you think it could have an impact? Or maybe get people who hadn't thought about electric appliances to reconsider?
I'm sure people may start thinking about that, but the point that you just made, Lee, about the electric, look, anyone that's had to have electric heat and you look at that electric bill after a cold winter, ooh-wee.
Right, yeah. Like, I mean,
It's hard to sell that to low-income and middle-income families. It's
Absolutely.
Already tough enough to pay the bills. And we all know Chicago gets cold. Mm-hmm. Like, come on now. That's tough.
Yeah. No, I mean, just speaking personally, I have, you know, gas, heat, and my electricity bill is still already, like, higher than my personal gas bill. And I think something that, you know, critics or people who have concerns about this, they want to make sure that the grid system, the, you know, the electric grid system that we have has the capacity to handle that. So I think it could, you could bring more people on board if you get, you know, ComEd to say, yes, confidently we could handle if the entire city of Chicago was, you know, went electric.
But that's the tough sell, because also people's gas, companies like that, they got a workforce as well, and they're thinking about the future of their operations. If we're going to cut gas altogether for future buildings, businesses, and residential, where do they fit in, you know?
Well, Brandon, while you're talking there, the mayor reopened the city's Department of the Environment, and now he's proposed that a pretty dramatic change, right? Does it seem clear environmental issues are a priority for him?
Yes, absolutely. It's something he ran on. Environmental issues are tough to communicate to a general voter base, though, you know, because it's tough to make that connection to, like, how does this apply to your daily life? And so that's the challenge that any candidate, any person in office has to deal with. And so that's the challenge for Mayor Brandon Johnson here. Mayor Lori Lightfoot attempted to step into this when and many critics within her office who left say it didn't go over well. So Johnson trying to correct that. He is a progressive mayor, the first, really the most progressive mayor the city's had, and maybe the most progressive mayor in America. So it's a real litmus test for how far can you go on those issues for a place like Chicago that's maybe not as far left as people think it is.
Yeah. I think also to the point of how do these issues affect people in their daily lives, we did see that a little bit during the Lightfoot administration when we had those fights about environmental racism, where industry is concentrated, which is mostly in the South and West sides. I know Little Village, you can probably speak to that, Madison, about how that community is
impacted. Factories, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's something I've recently spoken to people about, and, you know, maybe I can hint, got some stories in the future. But, yeah, I think some of the biggest issues facing the Southwest side that I'm personally curious to see how Johnson's administrations deal with. You know, there's a metal shredder in Pilsen, Sims Metal, that I've done quite a bit of reporting on that, you know, as well as other environmental reporters here in the city. The Hilco smokestack demolition, you know, from 2020, you know, a class action lawsuit was just settled with a multi-million dollar settlement from last week. But I don't think that's the end of that story. So I'm very curious to see how this Department of Environment deals with some of those.
And even beyond that, how do you handle carbon emissions? It's been well documented the issues with CTA and service. How do you prioritize that and get more people to ride public transportation and get less cars on the road? Chicago traffic lately seems like it's gotten worse.
Yeah, it sure has.
How do you get more cars off the road and get people back on trains and buses? That's a challenge as well.
Let's turn now to the escalating tension over the migrant situation. J.B. Pritzker joined other governors in asking Washington for help. Madison, fill us in.
Yeah, so Governor J.B. Pritzker joined, I believe, 8 other state governors in asking the federal administration to, quote, quickly negotiate a border security agreement.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I mean, does the federal government quickly negotiate anything? especially on such a hot button issue of immigration and this isn't the first time there's been this call for federal action. I mean, state, city, I mean, probably even county officials have been asking the federal government to step in. And while I do applaud this coalition of governors, I mean, across the country, I am personally extremely skeptical that it's really going to do much to urge the federal government to act.
Well, the Democratic governors, this is what they wrote, quote, "It is clear our national immigration system is outdated and unprepared to respond to this unprecedented global migration." So is it normal, Brandon, for governors to be confronting the president of their own party like this?
No, not at all. But look, what the Republican governors and Republican Party have done is they've taken a border issue, which affects border towns usually, and through political games like that they played with people's lives, have made this an issue that's a national issue now. So people that were ignoring the years-long border debates within the Republican Party, it's now becoming a multi-party conversation. And so it's forced the hand because we're seeing New York, Denver, Chicago, all dealing with this influx of asylum seekers and not having the resources to deal with it.
Yeah.
And these Republican governors and mayors say, well, we've been dealing with that. So now it's your turn.
Right.
So it's really pressure is on the Biden administration, all the Senate and House Democrats and Senate and House Republicans. But it's fascinating because is the pressure really on the Senate and House Republicans right now? Because you heard former President Donald Trump. He has basically signaled to House Republican leaders, maybe we shouldn't move on border policy until after this 2024 election.
Yeah, the former president, he is making the border crisis a focus of his reelection campaign, right? I mean, do Republicans want to find a workable solution at this point, Lee?
You know, I don't think they do, because it seems like Trump is still the, you know, de facto leader of the Republican Party right now. He is still appears to be the leader in the polls and the primaries at the moment. So this is another example of, you know, Trump governing by chaos and then House Republicans doing the same. I think it just shows how far we've come, not in a good way, over the last decade when it comes to just working across the aisle. I mean, I'm going to date myself here. I remember when I was an intern 10 years ago on Capitol Hill covering, you know, the border crisis then. And it seemed like we were going to get close to a deal. And now I just don't see even getting close.
Wow. Governor Pritzker is not only involved in a public spat with the president over immigration, but Mayor Johnson, too. This is over shelter space for migrants. Let's listen.
The city has not told the state where they would like us to put our resources to build new shelters or help them build new shelters. So we can't help if they don't identify those locations. And we need to make sure that we're not ending shelter capacity, as the city is now planning to do, at the end of winter.
So any of you surprised at all to hear the governor criticize Chicago like this?
Not particularly, because it's not the first time he's done it during this, you know, this crisis, this migrant situation. What does, I guess, a bit surprise me is how public the mayor and the governor are being with these, you know, dueling comments at press conferences or, you know, press releases from their spokespeople. It doesn't necessarily, yeah, it doesn't necessarily bode well for any kind of like party unity. Not saying that's really their goal. You know, it's almost seems like they're, you know, trying to score some points with being like, oh, I have the great idea of like how we're going to move this forward. And so we had Mayor Johnson kind of counter that, saying that the city has provided the state with a number of locations where they could build a shelter and that they don't necessarily have to build them in the city of Chicago.
Right,
that
he said they could be outside.
State. Yeah, but my understanding is that Pritzker responded with all of the infrastructure for this mission is in the city of Chicago. So that's where cities, I guess, or that's where shelters should ideally be placed.
That is a good point, actually. I did a story back in the fall. Mike Resky, he's a big developer in Chicago, and he had an idea to use some vacant or nearly vacant hotels out in the suburbs to house migrants. And one of the cons with that is that they are, you know, further from resources. You know, if they have to go to the hospital, which is all that's provided by Cook County, not the city, which handles the actual shelter. You know, they would have to go from the burbs into the city. So, yeah, it's a lot easier when everything is centralized. And, yeah, on the point, Sasha, of were we surprised by this? Absolutely not. There's so much tension that has been
reported. You all shook your heads.
Yeah. Even just talk. I remember talking to the governor in the fall at an event, and I asked him about the migrant crisis, and he said, well, the city hasn't made a formal request for funding. And it was a very odd, like, are you throwing the mayor under the bus in front of me? Is that what's happening?
Precisely.
Here? Yeah.
That's what he was doing. Well, you know, the mayor's facing a dilemma, right? If he sticks with this 60-day shelter policy, some 6,000 migrants could start being evicted next week, Madison. Yesterday, we know nearly a third of the alders asked him to scrap that policy. right? What happened?
Yeah. Well, yeah, a group of Alder people are asking the mayor to rescind the 60-day policy, at least until warmer weather, is my understanding. And this list of Alder people includes some really tight allies of the mayor, you know, you know, my Pilsen alderman, who I cover a lot, Byron Sigcho Lopez, he was one of those people that signed it, as well as Alderman Andre Vasquez, who heads the Committee on Immigrant, Migrant, and Refugee Rights. There's this real concern that if these evictions move forward, that's quoting the letter, that you're going to, or quoting Vasquez, that you're going to see these people just end up homeless again, that they're going to take shelter under viaducts, in parks, in tents. And winter is not over, you know, I think.
Right. Winter's not over. He halted these evictions in the first place because of the sub-zero cold. I mean, so do we think it's realistic then that there's a chance he delays it again?
I personally would not be surprised. Yeah. We've already seen it delayed twice.
This winter's not over, and it's unpredictable in this city.
Exactly.
So unpredictable.
Sometimes it doesn't end until May, realistically.
Sometimes.
Frequently.
Most times.
I don't put my coats away until Memorial Day weekend.
Well, I'm from Buffalo, so 40 degrees is spring.
I was just telling someone that I know that was trying to make outdoor April plans. I said, oh, no, honey. Don't do it.
Well, I just, you see once again with Mayor Brandon Johnson, a real test of what does having a progressive mayor actually mean, because the communities of color that help put him into that mayor's office do not lean as far left as a lot of his supporters actually are. And so this migrant crisis has kind of tested that. And so even in the back and forth with Pritzker, you see a tug of war between him trying to virtue signal to the people of color that elected him, saying, hey, I hear your concerns. There's only so much we can do. And then on the other end, trying to still, you know, have humane, safe, and welcoming policies that Chicago is known for as a city. It's a constant tug of war here. And you're seeing that play out with this 60-day eviction policy, with his own progressive allies joining in and saying, hey, man, we got to hold off on this. While other people within his base are saying, nah, just like in New York with Mayor Adams, we have to, you know, have a stop or some sort of controls at some point. So it's fascinating to see that tug of war play out.
As the city tries to find ways to help these migrants, some alders are calling for more oversight in how the city is spending its federal funding. What are the details here? The 34th Ward Alderman Bill Conway is introducing something?
Yes. So we introduced this earlier this week. Again, it was, spoiler alert, punted.
Another delay?
Over to rules. But basically, his proposal would require council approval before the city spends over $1 million in COVID relief funds. These are the funds under the American Rescue Plan Act. And so they were meant for COVID relief. If you go and look at all the different ways that you can use this money, it is actually pretty broad. And so the city does have some leeway to use it for the migrant crisis. However, alders like Conway were upset that the mayor didn't ask for approval before using $95 million of these funds back in December. Instead, the mayor took everyone into basically closed-door meetings with small tranches of alders and said, hey, this is how we're going to use these funds. From his perspective, he believes that is, you know, transparent and giving them a heads up. But from the perspective of Conway and the other now 27 alders who have signed on to his ordinance, that's not enough. And what's interesting, to the point on the last story we were talking about, this is getting support not just from more moderate alders and, you know, some of the really vocal critics against the mayor, like, you know, Lopez and Beal and Spezzato. It's also getting support from the progressive wing, from some of his supporters, like Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor, like Julia Ramirez, who, you know, was harassed by protesters who didn't want a camp in Brighton Park. Yeah. She called for transparency back then in October. And again, Andre Vasquez, who has also signed on to this. And I saw him on Monday, and he and Conway were talking about how much they like this proposal. So you're really starting to see that progressive wing, I don't want to say fall apart yet, but they're getting upset about this lack of transparency from the mayor, not just on the migrant crisis, but a number of issues.
All right, well, let's get off them and turn to Springfield, Brandon. Legislators have been weighing in on some potentially dangerous food additives. What's that about?
Yeah, it's called the Illinois Food Safety Act. It would ban lots of different food additives, red dye number 3 being one of them, potassium bromate, and some other ones that I cannot pronounce.
That should speak to why maybe they want to get rid of it.
Yeah, really speaks to it.
Propylparaben?
You said propylparaben. Is that how you say it?
I think so.
Beautiful. Well done. Well done. But if I can't say it, I probably shouldn't eat it. California passed a similar bill. I mean, that's the truth. California passed a similar bill. So this is kind of giving a lot of states momentum to kind of do their own. The concern here is that there's a lot of toxic effects that happen from red dye number 3 and bromate in particular to the thyroid, the kidney. And we all know that can do a lot of damage and have serious health consequences, heart disease, liver disease, high blood pressure, stroke, all kinds of
things. And we find these additives at the grocery store in those frosted pink and red cookies that my kids love to ask me to buy.
That red drink.
And, and items that are bright white. We talked about this earlier this week on Reset, and we had health coach Rochelle Trotter on. And here's a little bit of what she had to say about the potential dangers.
A lot of behavioral problems in kids, as well as reproductive issues relative to red dye number 5. If you're talking about titanium dioxide and things like that, that has been linked to cancer in lab animals. Brominated vegetable oil is a horrible one. It has been shown to cause thyroid issues in lab rats, but more than anything, that one has endocrine issues, which deal with the reproduction systems.
Yeah, it was a lot, and it was bad. Definitely something that we all need to be aware of.
I'm going to just eat a salad.
Yeah, so
can I not eat fruit roll-ups anymore?
We will see.
I think, like, what about, are all red things off the table? Like, I clearly need to be reading up
just look
for this.
Red dye number 3, and if it's not in there, you're good. So we're going to see whether that legislation passes. Even if it does, it wouldn't actually go into effect until 2027.
I'll probably have kidney disease by then.
Don't say that. All right, turning now to a series of stories involving Chicago police. Let's jump through these real quick. Superintendent Larry Snelling voiced his support for a technology that's come under a lot of fire, Madison. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Yeah, so this week was the first in a series of town hall events where Superintendent Snelling is talking to residents, answering questions. So this was earlier this week, he reaffirmed his support for ShotSpotter. So this very controversial technology, which it's not particularly surprising to hear him say that. He, in the past, has said that he is a big fan of technology as an asset or like a way to help police officers. So
he says it's the number one way for us to solve crime.
Yes, yes, he does. And I'd say the big counterclaim to that is there's been studies that question its efficacy and warn that it can contribute to like over policing. It picks up a sound, the sound of gunshots, and it sends police there. And if it picks up a sound that isn't gunshots, then you've just sent, police officers who are seemingly ready and prepared for gunfire to a situation where maybe it's not necessary. Mm. And while he was campaigning, Mayor Brandon Johnson, he campaigned on, questioning it, like wanting to end, like looking into ending the city contract, but kind of stopped short of explicitly saying he would cancel the city contract with it. So you have that, and you have the superintendent saying he's a fan of it.
Right.
It seems to me like the end of the story.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere.
There was also that strange thing that happened earlier this fall where ShotSpotter, not the contract that's up in February, but sort of a shorter-term contract, was renewed via like an automated signature.
Right,
there was
right,
a
right.
lot of confusion in City Hall around how that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one of those City Hall mysteries, for sure. Brandon, a Chicago police officer and his sister, they were sentenced this week. This was for their participation in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Where did the judge come down on these two?
Well, most people who were involved in the Capitol insurrection have faced at least a year of jail time.
Mm-hmm.
These two escaped jail time altogether. The judge acknowledged it was a lenient sentence. He gave them 3 months home confinement and 3 years probation.
Why?
The judge didn't feel like it was the sentencing didn't need to be too harsh because they had no criminal history and they were in the Capitol for 8 minutes and they were not violent. Keep in mind, Carol Chuswick, this is a former CPD officer. He was caught on camera wearing a CPD hoodie inside Nancy Pelosi's office in 4K. So, you know, there's currently at least 44 Illinois residents who have faced federal charges for their involvement in the Capitol insurrection. And this is the lightest of those sentences so far.
Interesting. Leave us with this. The city council is debating how police officers accused of misconduct will be disciplined. What is the latest?
Yeah, so Johnson asked the city council to reject for a second time an arbiter's ruling that would allow police officers represented by the FOP, that's the Fraternal Order of Police, who are facing severe discipline over a year suspension up to termination, to bypass the mayoral-appointed Chicago Police Board and instead have their fate determined by an independent arbiter. So the mayor decided, rather, you know, than have a potentially embarrassing vote on this, to send the matter back to committee supporters of the FOP tried to force a vote. They were defeated 27-20. But FOP President John Catanzara was there during this very contentious.
And he called the mayor a coward.
And he said, open your checkbook, because he says that his union would sue the city to enforce the arbiter's ruling.
All right, now we got to talk about sports. Brandon, last week we talked about the White Sox considering a move to the South Loop. Now I hear that Indiana is trying to lure the Bears. What's going on?
Yeah, it's enough to make you chuckle a little bit, but they think it's a reality. State Representative Earl Harris Jr., he represents East Chicago. He is the son of the late Representative Earl Harris Sr., whose dream was to bring a sports franchise to Northwest Indiana. He's trying to fulfill his father's mission, so he's developing a bill that would appoint a 19-member sports commission to recruit, ideally, the Chicago Bears to build their new stadium in Northwest Indiana, the region. They believe there's lots of great benefits. They think it's cheaper to build a stadium over there, which is true.
Yes.
They think it's not that far away from Chicago. It'd be, they say, about a similar distance to Arlington Heights. And great economic
benefits. Oh, is it really?
Yeah, and then it depends on where you're coming from.
Oh, okay. you left that out.
That's the trick. Hey, he's a politician. But also, they believe there's going to be great economic benefits, obviously, for Northwest Indiana, if that were to happen. But the chances of that seem pretty slim.
I mean, come on. Can we say that this is something like, you know, the New York Jets or the Giants who actually play in Jersey?
Right.
That's why the Buffalo Bills are the only New York team.
So true.
The only one in New York State.
Good point. The Washington Commanders, I think, are in Virginia.
Yep.
No.
FedEx?
No, they're in Maryland.
They're in Maryland.
Oh, they're in Maryland.
There you go. Yeah, they're in
Landover, Maryland.
Yeah, I just knew they weren't in D.C.
Yeah. So what do you think, Madison? The Indiana Bears. You going to a game?
Not to expose myself here, but I'm not really a, you know, Chicago Bears fan. But I don't think Indiana Bears has
how dare you say
as
that on
much airwaves. Of a ring, a good ring to it as the Chicago Bears does. I think it's a point of pride to have a team and a stadium in the city of Chicago. And I know they've, you know, talked about moving outside the city, but, you know, staying in Illinois. As someone who has very little stake in it, I do hope they stay in the city of Chicago. I hope they can make it work.
Mm-hmm. At this point, I mean, their top priority is a stadium. And so
that is true.
That's what they're going to try to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the Bears, Brandon, they've hired a new offensive coordinator who's Shane Waldron. Where is he from?
Yeah, Shane Waldron is the former offensive coordinator of the Seattle Seahawks. He helped Geno Smith become NFL's comeback player of the year in 2022. But he's received a lot of flack because his offenses aren't known to be creative, they're kind of boring, and people who are Bears fans are used to offenses that are not creative and kind of boring. That's why they let go of Luke Getsy. But there's a lot of interest and news around this hire in particular because the Bears have a huge decision. They have the number one overall pick in the NFL draft.
Mm-hmm.
Do they keep Justin Fields, or do they draft a new generational signal caller in Caleb Williams? And so people have been trying to read between tea leaves. Does this mean they're going to keep Justin, or are they going to go with Caleb? You think they're keeping Justin?
Yeah.
If I were a betting man, I'd bet they draft number one overall.
Really?
And trade Justin. Or maybe keep him and bench him.
Well, there was a big upset in Big Ten basketball on Wednesday. People were celebrating in Evanston, Brandon.
Good old Evanston, Illinois. They rarely get really big basketball moments, but their program's been rising. They got a big upset win in overtime over their state rival, U of I. And this was a huge Big Ten win for them. They're now 10-1 in the Big Ten at home.
Amazing.
That's huge for them as they look to build momentum and try to make the tournament. This is a team that's only made, I believe, one NCAA tournament in their entire basketball history. It's kind of surprising. You're in Chicago, a hotbed for basketball talent. You could be the Duke of the Midwest, you would think, but hasn't happened yet. But this is a momentum-building win for that program and bragging rights as well in-state.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Northwestern, the U.S. Department of Ed is investigating complaints of anti-Semitism at the university. What's that about, Madison?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've seen this play out at quite a few universities since the start of the Israel-Hamas war, that began in October. But like you mentioned, now Northwestern University is being investigated. A complaint was filed by the editor-in-chief of a conservative website over the university's response to allegedly anti-Semitic incidents. And these incidents, according to some reporting from the university student newspaper, included a vigil where the colors of the Palestine flag were projected onto a building and where there was a student walkout demanding the university end relationships with orgs that support Israel. I'll be curious to see how this investigation goes. You know, like I mentioned, we've seen these similar tensions play out at, you know, some of the highest universities in the country. And this, you know, seems like the closest one to home for us.
Wow. Shifting gears, Lee, you had a story that I wanted to bring in here. It was about the newly announced vice chair of World Business Chicago. Who's Charles Smith?
Yeah, so Charles Smith, he has a great story. He worked his way up from the mailroom at CNA Insurance when he was a young man, went on to found his own business, CS Insurance Strategies. And so, you know, he's very young. He's like 45 years old. And now he's taken on a role that Melody Hobson, she is CEO of Ariel Investments, mm-hmm. had. And, you know, World Business Chicago, this is a really important role. It's, works with the city and the business community to attract new businesses to Chicago, but also retain the ones that are here. And so, the other thing that's really interesting about Charles is he's a West Side native, and one of his priorities is connecting people from the neighborhoods, you know, like the West Side, to some of the big corporations in Chicago. Because when he was growing up, he said that, you know, he didn't have those opportunities. So I think it'll be a really interesting way to...
Nice little Chicago story.
Yeah, story, and also maybe see through some of the promises that, Brandon Johnson made on the campaign about sort of, you know, being the mayor of all of Chicago. Now, hopefully we have a business leader who can kind of tie in all of Chicago.
Right, right. Well, folks, voting has begun. No, I'm not talking about the March primary.
Oh my.
I am talking about the city's snowplow naming contest. Have you been paying attention? The Department of Streets and Sand has named the 50 finalists. I'm sure you've all been checking out the list. Among them are Better Call Salt, Buddy Geisicle, and Chance the Scraper.
Hmm.
Oh, there's even Skilling It.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Chicagoans can vote for up to 6 names on the city's website, and voting ends on February 2nd. Now, do any of those sound like winners to you all?
Gotta go with Skilling It, right?
Skilling It seems like a winner for sure.
I mean, to honor him, he's been on the air for so many years. It's just got a nice ring to it.
Yeah.
My favorite that you didn't mention, but is Casimir Plowowski.
Yes.
See, I knew one of you would have been paying attention to this.
My favorite is Austin Plowers. That's one of my
favorites. That's good, too.
Yeah. I'm not mad at Chance the Scraper.
I don't know.
We've done that already. Yeah.
Maybe come out with a better album and we'll talk.
Sorry, guys. I'm by myself on that one. Wow, guys. Wow. No support. All right. It's time for y'all to go. No, I'm kidding.
We've been cut off.
You've been cut off. Never again on the recap. No, but what's going on with y'all next week? What stories are on your radar? You firstly.
As always, have some city council and DNC stories in the cooker. So looking at those. I do also want to take this as a little chance, you know, PSA. I'm wearing a mask right now because COVID is still going around. So I want to urge anybody, especially if you're going to the doctor or a healthcare facility, mm-hmm. protect yourself, pop on a mask, protect other folks in Chicago.
Nice. Thank you, Lee. Brandon?
I've got two big exclusive interviews with Ryan Poles and Kevin Warren, the first black GM for the Bears and the first team president and CEO for the Bears, talking about their vision for the team, for the future.
Congratulations.
And we'll see. You'll hear things about the Bears that you might want to hear.
Ooh. Are they going to Indiana?
Oh. You'll find out.
Lies. Madison.
Something on my docket for next week is a public meeting regarding the demolition of the Damon silos down in McKinley Park. That's a story I've been covering for a bit. The Army Corps of Engineers is hosting this meeting because in order to demolish the silos, the contractors or the developers need a federal permit. So it's, you know, it's a little, niche.
You'll make it, you know, easy for us to understand, right?
Is that the end of the secret raves that go on around there? Yeah. It's been spreading all over TikTok.
I've heard about it.
All right, party animals, time to go. That's it for the recap. My thanks to Madison Saavedra, Lee John Greco, and Brandon Pope. Thank you all.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Andrea Guthman and edited by Dan Tucker and Linnea Dominic. If you liked this recap of the week's news, well, consider subscribing and leaving us a review. It helps people like you find us. Thanks for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again tomorrow.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.